teaching today, but last week I spoke of the wonderful privilege which is granted to believers when they cease to be in servitude to the devil and become loving servants, loving slaves of Jesus Christ. And it was only really as I came towards the end of my preparation, having thought about Nehemiah chapter 6, it was only when I came to the end of it that I began to see that there was a link between this chapter and what I shall say about it and what I said last week. And the link is this, that of course, as I said last week, everyone in this world has but one of two masters. We're either servants of the devil or we're servants of Jesus Christ. And those who become servants of Jesus Christ were once servants of the devil. Nehemiah 6 is about the devil's fight back. And it shows how determined the devil is to overturn God's work and to recover to himself God's people. He's a vicious enemy, and we are thankful that he is an enemy whose powers are limited. But chapter 6 of Nehemiah gives us an excellent insight into the ways the devil works. These, of course, are just a few of the ways he works. He uses so many means. But can we not see, as we have read through, the twists and the turns of his working? Of course, he's never mentioned in this chapter. His face never appears, but his fingerprints are all over it as he tries through these enemies of the Jews to overturn, to disrupt God's plan. And so this chapter stands to us as a warning that we have a very powerful enemy. But it also stands as a great encouragement that we have an even more powerful master. Let's consider then the way the chapter divides itself. There are this series of attacks of various sorts which Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem and those with them direct at Nehemiah and the Jews. And the first one is in the first four verses. The enemies are taken aback that the wall has been rebuilt against all their scornful predictions. Nehemiah and the Jews have succeeded in this massive job of rebuilding Jerusalem's walls, and it's almost complete. They have just to erect the gates. And so they come with subtlety. They come with, if you like, a baited hook, trying to entice Nehemiah, trying to entrap him. And it's interesting to notice, I think, that they don't say, come to Samaria, come to one of the other cities. Those other cities would have been what were called elsewhere in the Bible fenced cities. defended places, it would have been obvious that the intention was that Nehemiah should be captured and perhaps executed, and that the whole Jewish nation, as it had returned, would effectively be decapitated. But no, their plan is, their invitation is to come into one of the villages. It doesn't, you know, it's only a small place. There isn't an army there. There are no walls. You can easily come and go as you please. And here is the devil at work, isn't he? In his subtlety. We only need to think immediately of the devil as the serpent in the Garden of Eden. Such a subtle, gentle, reasonable approach. And how often he comes to us in that way. So plausible. Thankfully, Nehemiah was given wisdom to see what underlay this subtle approach. And then in the next few verses, verses 6 through to 9, verses 5 through to 9, Sanballat writes again in a different way. And he's giving Nehemiah what seems to be, if you read it carefully, it seems to be a kindly warning. He says, it's reported among the heathen, and Gashmu saith it, that thou and the Jews think to rebel, to which cause thou buildest the wall, that thou mayest be their king according to these words. And thou hast also appointed prophets to preach of thee at Jerusalem, saying, there is a king in Judah. And now shall it be reported to the king, according to these words. Come now, therefore, and let us take counsel together. The sense, I think, is that he's saying, look, you're running into danger, Nehemiah. You're going to get yourself on the wrong side of the king, and I'm here to help you. And of course he's not. It's a false friendship, and it's based on false accusations. And Nehemiah again is able very readily, very rapidly to dismiss that. And then, as we go further, verses 10 through to 14, Shemaiah tries to persuade Nehemiah to come into the temple, to hide himself away, to be safe from those who will, so it said, attack him. And here's another subtlety, isn't it? It's not go and hide in your house. It's not even in a sort of open declaration of who is going to be threatening Nehemiah. But it's come to the temple. It acquires an air of sanctity. But it's an act of cowardice. And the label I've attached to it is sanctimonious cowardice. And that's something that we too can be at risk of. We can we can be very fearful of men, and we can adduce in our minds all sorts of reasons why that's not an improper thing to happen. We can find other more pressing things to do. We can suggest to ourselves that actually God will be at least as well served. Perhaps we might argue better served doing something which suits us rather than doing something which is plainly God's commandment. Our minds are ready agents of the devil. And as he twists and turns, so our own minds twist and turn, don't they? The enemies of the believer are the world, the flesh, and the devil. And we, sadly, are so often in danger of being the devil's allies. So here is a false prophet, and he's doing his best to induce Nehemiah to retire through fear of what men will do to him. And again, not only in our own personal lives is that so, as I've already suggested, but how much is that the case out there in the so-called Christian church at large? People will try to balance things. I don't know how much you follow these things, but you may perhaps have seen a statement by the Archbishop of Canterbury regarding the pressure which the Canterbury MP, Rosie Duffield, has come under from the LGBT lobby, because she has dared to say that those who are physically women are women. And the Archbishop's statement, it sort of equalizes these two views and says, well, you know, whichever side you're on, let's be kind to one another, as if there was no value difference between those views. And that's such a common thing in Christian circles, sadly, in these days. And let's move on further down the chapter. We read in between that again the enemies of the Jews were cast down because the wall has now completely finished, and they still persist. And what's more, they have a degree of success. In verse 17 to the first part of verse 19, moreover, in those days, the nobles of Judah sent many letters unto Tobiah, and the letters of Tobiah came unto them. For there were many in Judah sworn unto him, because he was the son-in-law of Shechaniah, the son of Ara, his son Johanan had taken the daughter of Meshullam, the son of Berechiah. Also, they reported his good deeds before me, and uttered my words to him. The enemy within. Now that can be looked at a number of different ways, can't it? I've already spoken about the aid which our own hearts give to the devil. So that's one way of looking at it. but also in the church. One of the saddest things, one of the most difficult things to contend with is church disunity. These Jewish leaders were in cahoots with Sanballat. They were in his pocket, if you like, and they were doing their best. Leaders though they were doing their best to undermine Nehemiah, who was the appointed leader of the whole group. And then, of course, another enemy within is the corruption of teaching. How subtle that is, that the sound doctrine can be little by little tweaked and tweaked and tweaked until we find that a church, a group, a preacher, whatever it may be, is actually setting forth doctrine which is not scriptural at all, which is damaging to souls. Finally, the last act in this chapter of the Jews' enemy, they've tried all these various subtle ways, enticement, false friendship, false prophets, and trying to inject fear into Nehemiah's heart. They've used the Jews themselves as enemies against Nehemiah and the other faithful Jews. None of those has worked. So here we have in the last line of the chapter, and Tobiah sent letters to put me in fear. Outright threats. And the devil can be an angel of light. He can be a roaring lion. And he can be many things in between. So here is the devil trying his utmost to recover what he considers is his, what has been his at one time, trying to disrupt God's plan, trying in every way he can to overturn God's work. And if we simply were to stop there, of course, it would be a very daunting, depressing account, wouldn't it? But let's think about how Nehemiah responded. He's devoted to his master's service. He's determined that what he has been appointed to do will be done. He's a faithful man. Verse 3, they've written to him. They've given him this invitation to come down to one of the villages. And his answer is a very simple one. I'm doing a great work so that I cannot come down. Why should the work cease whilst I leave it and come down to you? He doesn't hesitate. And his eyes are Godward, aren't they? And shouldn't that speak to us of our need to shrug off all these attacks, to hear what the Lord is saying to us as far as what is our appointed path, and to remain with it whatever may come. I brought to my mind first couple of verses of Hebrews 12, Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us. Let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. We should, I trust we can, stand in that place and look to the Lord. So Nehemiah is a devoted servant of his master. He's also quite plainly, as you read through the whole book of Nehemiah, he's a man of intense prayer. If you go back to chapter 1, there is an extended prayer recorded there as Nehemiah expressed to the Lord his concern about the state of Jerusalem and how reestablishment was to be achieved. But then as you go through, and if you've read through Nehemiah, as I'm sure you have, you will notice that again and again he makes these very brief, I hope this doesn't sound irreverent, but they're almost kind of top-up prayers. I've got to some particular crisis, a particular difficulty, and it's a Lord help me prayer. Help me get over this hump. Hold my hand on this path. So much a message to us, isn't it? That we need to be like that, not simply focusing on our set times of prayer, our quiet times, but through the day, as events unfold to us, asking the Lord's help, seeking his presence. See how brief in verse 9, see how brief in this chapter his prayer is. Now therefore, O God, strengthen my hands. And we do talk about in our prayer meetings, prayers being specific. That's a pretty specific prayer. He needs help to resist the enemy at that point. So he's a man of prayer, as well as being devoted to the one to whom he prays. But he's also, and it comes across so much in Nehemiah, doesn't it, in the book of Nehemiah, he's also an intensely practical man. He doesn't, I don't want to mischaracterize or say anything inappropriate in this, but he doesn't make his prayers and sit there and wait for things to happen. He has acted clearly in the first place under God's direction, and he's now, throughout the book, involved in great activity. The walls of Jerusalem must be built. And he's if you read through it, he's chasing the people to get them built. He's commenting on those who didn't put their heart to the work. And he's commending those who did more than their share. He's constantly driving these people along because this is an important work. The gates are still to be set up. And if you go back to chapter 4, let me remind you, as I'm sure you probably remember anyway, the people were to work and fight. Those who were building the wall were to have their shield and their spear beside them. They would have their sword, it actually says in their hand, while they were working. I don't know whether that's literally true. It must have been quite difficult to work if it were the case. But at least their sword by their side, ready for immediate action should the enemy attack. They had to work and they had to fight. And then the third area of action which Nehemiah was pressing home in a very practical way was that the people's sins, his own sins, must be dealt with. The personal sins. He speaks in the chapter that we read, he's not confessing his sins, but he's as it were guarding against them by the way he speaks. Forgive me. He says, "Shall such a man as I," verse 11, I said, "Should such a man as I flee? Who is there that, being as I am, would go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in." He's not boasting. He's not saying, "I'm a brave man and I'm not afraid of anybody." He's saying, "I'm God's man." And to take the action which was being put into his mind is a God-dishonoring action. So he's seeking to root out that sin and to ensure that it's kept in its place. And then later on, his great activity in chapter 13, the last chapter of the book especially, where he is very active in pressing home the obligations of Sabbath observance among the people and among those who come to trade. We read there of him driving away the people who came on the Sabbath. And also, and how difficult one this must have been, pressing home the forbidding of mixed marriages. What a painful process that must have been. But again, they are done because these are the things which God requires. By these things, God is honored. So, simply to summarize then, the devil is a lively enemy. We should not necessarily attribute all our difficulties, all our setbacks to the devil's work. That isn't necessarily so. Some things are appointed by the Lord for our benefit, for, if you like, the smoothing of the stone so that it may eventually glisten. But that said, the devil takes every opportunity that he can to seek to undermine our faith, to overturn God's work. He will search out, he knows to a great extent, he will search out all our weakest points. He will take every advantage of them. But we have this means of defense, as Nehemiah did. We need to keep our eyes fixed on God. We need to be faithful in his service. How much we need that we should be praying. And as I've said, not just in at appointed times, but moment by moment. And I'm convicted by that, because I know I don't. We should. And then we have to put our hand to the work, God's work. And he will grant his blessing if we do. I shall leave it there. Trust that you will be helped by those thoughts. And shall we sing again? Hymn number 718. Oft in danger, oft in woe, onward, Christians, onward go. Fight the fight, maintain the strife, strengthened with the bread of life. 718. All right, bye.
7, 8, 1.
Do either.
But if you found 7, 8, 1.
is for you, the maker.